The following presentation was recorded at the 1996 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Good morning. I'd like to begin by asking you a question. Maybe a few questions. Who are you? If you were to describe yourself, how would it all come together? I've asked the question before. When someone says, "Who are you?" You know, I might say, "Well, my name is Brandon Mollett. I'm from Napanee, Indiana, originally." And you could say, "Well, no, that's where you're from, but who are you?" And so I might try again. I might say, "Well, I'm a teacher. I have four children. I'm married." And they say, "Well, that's what you do. You have a family, but who are you?" And we think about character and its development. Another question we could ask is, how many of you can look at everything in your life that's happened to you and make sense out of it? Just think for a moment. Your family, all life events, things that happen to you, can you look at all of those things and does it make some sense? And if it does, how did you arrive at that point? Brother Melvin mentioned Joseph. And Joseph is a prime example, as he said, of someone who had character. Excuse me a minute here while I get this. His life is a classic example. His childhood was far from ideal. His mother died when he was young. He was his father's favorite. And as the youngest of more than 10 children, we know that could be problematic. His dreams inflamed his brother's hatred. They betrayed him. He was sold as a slave. He was double-crossed, as Melvin mentioned this morning, his story, and he was jailed and forgotten. The butler and the baker forgot him. And if we read his story up to that point, we would expect a bitter, cynical, resentful, angry man. But we know the story, and we know that he's not any of those things. And I'd like to read just two verses at the end of Genesis, chapter 50. Instead of this bitter, angry, resentful man, in Joseph we find, after Jacob had died and his brothers experienced a new wave of terror over their sin against Joseph, they came to him again, and Joseph said, "Don't be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring it to pass, or to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. Now therefore, fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. How did Joseph make sense of his past? Think yet again another story, the slave girl to Naaman. And we heard the story in chapel yesterday here at the school. But enemy soldiers come racing into town and rip her away from parents. And she's taken to be the house girl to a Syrian soldier named Naaman. She was part of war plunder. That's all she was, part of the plunder. And yet she was faithful to Jehovah. She knew God's power. When Naaman needed healing, she knew where to tell him. She knew where the prophet was. She knew where to send him. What happened when the king of Israel was contacted about the problem? He tore his robe. He says, he wondered, am I God? He didn't know where the prophet was until someone sent a message. And, oh, yeah, hey, send him over there. You know. Why the difference between the king and the slave girl? And we could speak of other people as well. Daniel and his three friends. All of these, whatever produced them, we want it for our children. What was it that produced them? That's what we want to talk about this morning a little bit. What was it? What was the secret? I can guarantee you I won't give you that. I'll give you some ideas. But what are some broad issues, at least, this morning that we can look at in this search for what it is that brings about character? And as Melvin said, crisis doesn't shape character, it reveals it. And so, what is it that brings about character that when crisis comes, good things happen? First thing I'd like to look at, I basically just tell you about two principles that are sort of guide my thinking this morning. And the first one is that the shaping influences of life have a lot to do with who we are today. The shaping influences of life. And this includes our physical makeup, our life experiences. And it can be our family history. It can be the kinds of roles that mom and dad played out in family. It can be the way we resolve conflict and disputes in our families. And it can be the way we responded to failure. How does your family respond to your failure? Was it condemnation and shaming and guilt and rejection? Or was there still complete acceptance and love and affirmation, godly correction and discipline? Which was it? All of these things and more, the things that happen to us, the shaping influences of our lives. Now, it's pretty clear, if we think about that, that we're leaving out another dimension in thinking about who we are. And especially when you think about Joseph being carried off to Egypt, and that all happened to him. Well, what was it that kept him from becoming that bitter, angry man? As we study his life, we see in Joseph a Godward orientation. We see a Godward orientation. And this simply, what we're talking about here is this determines how the child interacts with the experiences that life dishes out. And we say life. I want to clarify that more as we go on. But today I want to look at these two issues and consider their implications. Won't talk much more about them directly, but it really is the foundation for what I want to say. And we, in concluding that thought there, we're not merely acted upon by the circumstances of life. We respond, we react, and notice that we reject two things. We reject a deterministic view of life. In other words, that what happened to me, I can't change it. That part of it may be true. And because of what happened to me, I can't change today. Okay? That shaped me. It's just like pouring concrete. There's no way I can change the form of that concrete anymore. It's a deterministic view. And what we're talking about this morning rejects that view. That we cannot help how we are today. Okay? The second thing that it rejects is a denial of what happened. I cannot deny that bad things happen to me. That's a fact. I cannot deny that. To deny it is to be untruthful about a significant part of who I am. And so when we think about shaping influences and we think about Godward orientation, I need to reject these two things, that I can't help the way I am and that bad things didn't really happen. Well, it was bad, but it doesn't really matter. Didn't really affect me. Well, I want, first of all, to look at some theoretical and developmental things. The title does hint toward that. Character development, childhood development. What are children like? How does that affect what they become? And then I want to talk some about some of the big picture things in character formation. Just some considerations here, first of all. The importance of the heart in character development. Proverbs 4:23 exhorts us to keep the heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. For out of it are the issues of life. Now, another translation would say, guard your heart. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. And if you just think in pictures for a moment, imagine your heart at the bottom of your life. And out of that heart is springing, is welling up everything that other people experience when they experience you. When they relate to you, they're experiencing what is welling up out of that heart. That's where it all starts. For out of it are the issues of life. It is the wellspring of life. Jesus affirmed those very same words in Mark chapter 7, verse 21, when he said, for from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. Out of the heart. So the heart determines behavior. And somehow, when we go about developing character, working with God and developing character in children, we have to remember that it starts in the heart. How does what I do to and for the child, how does it get at his heart? It has to start there. And I want to say more about this later, but if all I do is make him be a good boy, just act right, I haven't touched his heart. And many times as a parent, in preparing for this talk, you know, I'm sitting in the middle of the house where all the activities going on. And what happens when children come up and want your attention and you're trying to think? You want to push them away. And at that point, they tend to be irritations. Okay? So my parenting at that point tends to become, just produce good behavior. That's all I want. Okay? Just go play. Okay? Stop crying. I don't know why you're crying. Just stop crying. I don't want to hear it. It's distracting. That's not addressing the heart. The second thing we notice about the heart is that the thirst of the heart can only be satisfied in truly knowing God. Now, again, we can, just for instance, if we want to teach a child about where the value of possessions comes in on the scale of importance. A child, I don't know if you've noticed this, if you have children or you've taught long enough to observe this, that when a child knows he's going to get something, a present, it's his birthday and he knows that people are going to buy presents. Or if it's almost Christmas and he's going to get presents and he's excited. And I'll be honest, I'm affected by Christmas too. December is a fun month for me. I enjoy, except for the busyness sometimes. How much of my joy in December comes from knowing that I'm going to get extra things? Okay. How much of my life comes out of knowing that I get more things? I get something new. And I wonder what it is, and I can't wait. Okay. And so my heart is finding life and fulfillment in things. Well, how do I help my child who can't wait for his birthday because grandpa promised to get him a new bike for his birthday? Or whatever he may be promised. How can I develop in my child a true sense of knowing that only God can truly satisfy the desires of the heart? And how does that look in early childhood? How does that look when he's 10 years old? How does that look when he's 15? Second thing I'd like to consider is the value of a relationship with a child as a context for developing character. Relationship. And I'd like to make the word communication almost synonymous with relationship. True intimacy, someone has said, is not the way the culture would define it in physical love, but true intimacy is words. because it's in words that we communicate. Remember, Jesus Christ in John 1 has said that he was the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. So we saw God through Jesus Christ, but he was the Word. And language is very close to personality. And communication, it's in communicating with our children that we begin to know the person and begin to touch the real person. Ted Tripp, who wrote the book Shepherding a Child's Heart, has a model in here that I'd like to just share with you. He talks about that most of us in our homes now, I'm thinking more families, and perhaps even in our classrooms for that matter, most of us, we think of discipline in our homes as rules, correction, and discipline. All right, those three things. And that seems to be a complete model for the structure that we want to provide for our children. But he goes on to point out that the Bible covers far more than just these three things. These by themselves are not a sufficient model or a sufficient way to reach deeply into the lives of our children. The Bible uses words like encouragement, correction, rebuke, entreaty, instruction, warning, teaching, admonition, showing the benefits, and obedience. Now just think about these for a moment. If I simply try to correct the child and say, look, if you get that living room cleaned up in 5 minutes, I'll give you a candy bar. Okay? A lot of children, that would motivate. Okay? Oh, yeah, thanks, Dad, I'll do it. And they quick do it, and they get the candy bar. Ah. But they have not needed to respond to you. You've given them a selfish motivation out of which to respond and do the right thing. If I can do the right thing, I'll get something. Okay, now I'm not saying it's always wrong to do that. But if that's your primary means of getting the behavior you want, you're not really teaching the child about his heart, about how he thinks and about what motivates him. But when your training and discipline can include all these things, encouragement. Sometimes when a child is throwing a fit or acting something out and you begin to talk to the child, you realize that what they were really feeling was that they weren't good enough, that people didn't like them or something. And what they really don't need as much as correction and rebuke, perhaps, is just encouragement. Other times, we do need to give correction. We need to rebuke. And that's where it's a very upfront, face-to-face encounter saying, you were wrong. And I expect that to stop. And entreaty. Read the first half of Proverbs and notice how he entreats his son. He entreats. He pleads. He begs his son to heed his commandments, his instruction, his wisdom. Instruction is teaching and imparting knowledge and showing how. Warning is pointing over there and you say, you see that? That's the result of this. And I warn. And I teach. I impart new knowledge. I admonish. I show the benefits. Just as well as warning, I can point over there and say, you see that? That's the benefits of following God with your whole heart. That's the benefits of being the right kind of person. And then, of course, obedience. All has to do with communication. Engaging the whole child, and not just his behavior, but reaching down into the heart. I'd like to talk now about some developmental considerations as we think about child training and character development. It is true. Here just the other week in our family Bible reading time, one of my boys asked me a question about what was read. And, you know, I'm a relatively new parent, and I always, as soon as I get these opportunities, I want to jump on them and really go for it. And about 20 seconds into my explanation, he was gone. I mean, he was sitting there, but I could tell he was totally disengaged. He had heard the first 15 seconds, and that was enough. He didn't want to hear more. Well, it's reflecting a little bit his age, okay? He doesn't really have the capacity to understand long paragraphs on abstract things about whatever it was we were talking about. Infancy to childhood, 0 to 5 years. We're talking primarily, the key word here is change, dramatic change. And we see this in children. I have 3 children in this age bracket. And the youngest one is about to turn 1 year old. Now, in this 1 year, he has gone from complete immobility. I mean, very difficult to move much of anything with any kind of purpose except maybe to wave a little bit when you cry. You watch an infant, a newborn infant cry. They basically just lay there like this and cry. You know, they don't move a whole lot. Basically immobile at birth. By the time they're 5 years old, if anybody plays with them much at all, they can probably hit a ball with a bat. They can probably bounce a basketball with some degree of coordination. That's just physical change, dramatic change in 5 years' time. You won't see that much change from 20 to 25 in physical development from 20 to 25, as you will in 0 to 5. That's physical change. Social change is also radical. He learns, the child already begins to learn what endears him to other people. He learns what works in relating to other people. And by the time he's 5 years old, he probably has some friends. He's already developed the ability to have friends. And there's certain people that he likes, he or she likes to be with. And so there's tremendous change from being only concerned about themselves at birth. I'm hungry, so I cry till I eat. To having friends and knowing how to give and take. And then, of course, there's intellectual change. Every experience in this time frame is a learning experience. He has tremendous curiosity, tremendous strides in language. Forgive me for talking about my children, but they're probably just almost as smart as yours. The youngest one, he's not a year old yet, and yet when we talk, I'm holding him and I call up the stairs to somebody. What does he do? I'm holding him there and I say, Patrick, you ready to go? He'll go, you've heard him. He's calling up the stairs too. He's already learning certain, why is it that when you call, the tone of voice goes a certain way. When you ask a question, we usually, hello? It always goes up. Well, children soon learn the directions of vocal inflections and all that. Very early. Tremendous change intellectually. And then, of course, there's spiritual change. And this is hard to define. Some people, of course, would say that you want the child to make a commitment to God early on. 3 years old, that's great. Get him to repeat it after you. But I think we do have to recognize whatever we've believe about that, we do have to recognize that there is some sort of spiritual awareness developing. And how to foster that and nurture it is a challenge. But there's tremendous change. And what we do want to do in the spiritual area is develop in them this whole idea of the ability to know and love God. At least that. The ability to know and love God. That there is that possibility. There is a God. And we can know him. Well, the next category, and I'm just taking the big picture here in these stages, I'm just calling it childhood, 5 to 12 years of age, elementary years. And the key word here would be character development. Perhaps I should mention in the infancy to childhood stage, the one big lesson that we want children to learn is this whole idea of authority. Who is in charge? And how do I respond to mom and dad? And, our basis for this is really Ephesians 6, 1 to 3. Children, obey your parents, Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. Because if you do, it'll go well with you and you'll live long on the earth. Okay, so what motivates me as a parent, it's not just so they listen to me and obey me. I train because I want it for the well-being of the child. That's really what I'm after. And I tell my children this, look, I want you to listen, not because I think I just want to be listened to, but because it's for your good. Because I know that if I don't make sure you know how to listen, that life is going to be difficult. It's going to be hard for you to know God and to love God if I don't teach you how to listen to me. And so that is the one big lesson that I believe children need to learn. And one writer that I looked at as I was studying for this, he talked about obedience. And he says obedience ought to be always without excuse, without challenge, and without delay. Now, if you've parented very long, that's a challenge to try to parent so that that is the eventual product or manifestation in the child. Without excuse, without challenge, without delay. Well, what is the primary means that the Bible gives us to drive foolishness out of the heart of a child? Proverbs, a number of places, talks about this and says, and let me just paraphrase, that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. So the rod is there to drive it out. And we, of course, need to be discerning and need to know ourselves. Can't do it in anger. Can't do it out of a loss of control. Need to be consistent with it. But the Bible talks about the rod driving the foolishness. And don't let your soul spare for his crying. I don't like that verse. Don't let your soul spare for his crying because you're doing him a favor. You're saving his life when you do it. Well, back to childhood. 5 to 12 years, character development. So in the early stages, we have taught the child, hopefully, we've taught the child what obedience is and how to relate to authority. And now we look at character development. You know, my son can listen to me, my 8-year-old can listen to me and be perfectly obedient and do what I say. But I can tell when he's feeling extremely selfish about what he's doing. And my addressing the issue of obedience is not going to address his selfishness. And he may obey simply to stay out of trouble. He may obey because he wants to please. But he does not always act unselfishly because he is reaching out to the people from his heart. He's simply staying out of trouble. And so I want to develop character in the areas of being unselfish and considering other people and kindness and all those things that we want to work on. But it comes out of this, first of all, knowing what obedience is. A couple things that tend to sidetrack us in character development. I've already alluded to some of them, but we can get sidetracked with rules. And if something doesn't work, we tend to find a rule to fix it. And someone has said, maybe it was Gene Edwards that said, that rules are made by people who like to go to bed early. Okay? And that's true. Think about it. Rules, we'd like to make rules so we don't have to actively engage with the person. We have a problem with somebody, well, let's just make a rule, and that won't happen again. Okay? We'll just take care of it. And it helps us get to bed early. Well, rules sidetrack us from character development because we don't have to engage with the child. We don't have to engage with the person. And what we really do when we focus on rules is we develop good Pharisees. Think about it. The Pharisees were great at keeping rules. They were masters. They had mastered the art. But inside, Jesus said, they were full of dead men's bones. There was no life there. They were the most pious, high-minded people you could find. Also, the most condemning. Of anybody else, it didn't quite match up. They condemned them. They had it put together. Nobody else did. They did not tolerate failure. And when we raise our children on the idea that if they can keep the rules, and notice, rules focus on obedience. But obedience is only one quality. It's a primary one, but it's only one quality of character. And rules just focus on that. And we can have very good little boys and girls but very selfish, very undeveloped in character when we focus only on rules. And again, we need to learn how to address the heart. There's basically three things when we address the heart. We have to look at when something happened. Determines a little bit how we address it. We have to look at when it happened. We have to look at what happened. And we have to look at why. And again, the earlier you are in this stage, the less time you better spend on why. At least in terms of asking why. The child may not be able to articulate very well the why. He knows what. Okay? But may not know very well the why. But again, this is a training time. We begin to inform the child, here's why. Here's what your heart is saying. Here's what you were feeling and thinking. Here's what was motivating you to do that. And we begin to address character. And we appeal to conscience, and the conscience begins to develop. I'll give you another definition for character, very similar to the one that Melvin gave you this morning. And this one says that character is simply living consistently with who God is and with who I am. Living consistently with who God is and who I am. And we want to develop that in the child. I want to talk a little bit later about how parents need to live the same way, and teachers as well. There's another comment here that character development is a process and not an event. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a process. We look at teenagers, and if I had to talk about them from personal experience in my own family, just offer you some things to consider. A few things that happen in the life of a teenager, of course, is the onset of puberty and dramatic change, again, physically and emotionally and personality. And really, the benchmarks of this time period in life are really about from the time that puberty begins till the time that they reach adulthood, leave home. And probably the one thing that would characterize teenagers is just the onset of insecurity. That's probably one of the biggest things that is demonstrated in this time is insecurity. And just think about it. The person is neither a child nor an adult. They're right in between. Now, we could talk, I know there's people that have made some pretty good arguments about the fact that before this century, nobody talked about this time period any differently than they talked about adulthood. And there are some very good reasons for thinking that way. But think about it this way. How many times have you heard a 14-year-old being told, grow up, act your age? And the next time's being told, you can't do that, you're not old enough. Okay? They're right in between. And they a lot of them look almost adult, and yet emotionally and in character, perhaps, they may not yet be there. A couple observations. They're vulnerable about everything. Okay, very sensitive. They can have a lot of anxiety about who they are, what people think. Great awareness is growing here about what other people do. And how they think and what they believe and how it differs from what I believe and how it differs from what I do. And there can be a lot of anxiety. And as teachers and parents, we need to be alert to that, recognize it as a fact, and figure out how to help them. They're often unstable. Sometimes you'll hear teenagers argue both sides of an idea in one conversation. One moment they'll be arguing this side, the next time they'll be arguing this side. Well, that's great. I love to hear them do that. They're just figuring it out. They're just trying to figure out exactly what it is that they think about things. There's a lot of insecurity about their bodies, how they look, how they appear. Of course, and I mentioned already personality. There's a lot of apprehension about personality. Bottom line is they're really seeking to establish some level of independence. Who am I anyway? If they've grown up being defined by the family, and that's great, but they kind of want to know, well, just who am I? And a lot of times we look at the teenage years as a time of rebellion. And the families that I've observed, my observation simply would be that rebellion in teen years seems to grow out of unaddressed rebellion in early childhood. And that's the frightening thing for me as a young parent. I wonder, how well am I addressing those issues now? Because the families that I notice that don't really struggle with a lot of teen rebellion, there may be one exception in their family for whatever reason. But as a rule, in their family, if the teens do not struggle with rebellion, there's been obedience has been addressed early on in the heart. It's not obedience making rule-conscious children, but obedience from the heart and a relationship, communication with the parent. Sometimes rebellion in the teen years, what is rebellion or what looks like rebellion, sometimes just a misguided attempt to establish their own identity. Who am I? So I just kind of all of a sudden charge off another direction just to kind of show that, hey, I'm me, you know. And I don't necessarily, I look at that rebellion as a little differently than the deep-rooted rebellion of being set on my own way in all my life, in all areas of my life, and spurning correction from parents and others in my life. Well, I think the key thing that we need to focus on here is simply giving teenagers a foundation for life. And I'm not going to take the time to read Proverbs here, but three things that Proverbs 1 addresses. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord. Secondly, Proverbs is full of these pleas to the son or to the daughter to listen to their instruction. Listen to your father. Listen to your mother. And don't spurn their correction, their rebuke, their instruction. And then, of course, in chapter 1 especially, we read that account where it says, my son, if sinners entice you, is it chapter 1 or somewhere in the first four chapters, if sinners entice you, consent thou not. And it describes what sinners would like to do with you. And so there's this exhortation to disassociate with the wicked. Don't keep company with evil people. Because here's what they'll do. And the proverb writer sets out to describe what happens. Well, in terms of helping, especially teenagers, but our children, think about three overarching goals. If we look at children from beginning to, let's say, 21, 18 or 21, three things. We want them to have a living faith. And I'd like to just share a model of faith that I found to be very helpful in thinking about what kind of faith do I want to see developed in my children? Here's a model of faith. I get this out of the book entitled From Boys to Men. It's about developing character in boys by Lee and Clark. But they give this model for faith. And you notice the graph has high complexity, low complexity, weak simplicity, strong simplicity. So we're putting simplicity and complexity on a graph and trying to chart and see what combinations we come up with. And the first one that they look at is a neglected faith. And this one is characterized by a lack of trust and commitment to the basic truths of Scripture and a weak or absent imitation of godly qualities and behaviors. There's really little or no thinking or questioning about the Christian life. These people, these children know the lingo. They know their behavior, but there's really no demonstration of faith, of a living embrace of who Jesus Christ is and what it means to be a child of God. It's a neglected faith. Well, then on the other side of simplicity, we have childlike faith. Just ignore this down here. Childlike faith. And isn't this what Jesus talked about? If you want to be a part of the kingdom, you have to become as a child. And this is characterized by a personal commitment to follow Christ and live a life that will be pleasing to Him. The emphasis is on trusting God, obedience, and doing what God commands. If you love me, keep my commandments, Jesus said. We want this kind of faith in our children. We give them godly examples they can imitate. And we want this in our children. But it is a childlike faith. It's a trusting faith. It's characterized by obedience. We surround them with Bible stories and perhaps, maybe, some easy answers. And thinking deeply and critically about their faith can be seen as dangerous by children who have only a childlike faith. Now, I don't want to leave the impression that this is a bad faith. It should not be scorned in the life of a child or an older person. It's to be admired. The older we get, the less of a childlike faith we tend to have. But I don't believe it's the kind of faith we want in totality. And then Lee and Clark talk about a reasoned faith. And this faith is characterized by complexity of thinking. And this is where I tended to be growing up. I had great interest in understanding and gaining a lot of knowledge about Christianity, about life. But acts of service, prayer meetings, that's, not as important. I tend to diminish or scorn childlike faith. It's too simplistic. It doesn't answer all the questions. And so there is a developing cynicism in a child who has a reasoned faith. These people love to think. They love head knowledge. They like to talk about the Bible. They just have a hard time living it. Really don't know how to put it in the shoe leather. Well, the fourth one that Lee and Clark talk about is mature faith. And this is a blending of a reasoned faith and a childlike faith, a blending of the two. And it's the faith is both childlike and it has a reasoned faith, a strong commitment to simple imitation of Christ. Obedience combined with a thoughtful consideration of one's faith. There's a well-rounded integration of the simplicity of the simple and the complex. And so a lot of times we tend to see a child's movement back and forth between these two, especially when they get over here to reasoned faith. We see it as very dangerous, and we sometimes condemn or exhort children not to, you're asking too many bad questions, too many hard questions. You don't need to think about that. It's hard to find answers to all of life. You just have to forget about that. Okay, well, we're missing an opportunity to help them bring together a childlike faith and a reasoned faith into a mature faith characterized by obedience and acknowledgement that there are difficult questions. Why is there child abuse? Why is there suffering, starvation? Just the other morning, I read again where Jesus said that in the last, he would give a parable, and he said, at that time, that's how God is going to do. He's going to separate the wicked, and he's going to throw them into this fiery furnace, and there's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And I'm thinking, God, how can you do that? How does God go from loving all these people to do that? I can't quite explain it. I know it's true. I believe it. I order my life around it. It is difficult to explain. Okay. Something else that I believe we need to focus on, besides encouraging a living faith, is developing a relationship with our children that encompasses all those things I spoke of earlier. If we think about authority and influence, there's another chart to help us think about this. When a child is born, I have very little influence over that child. When it cries, I make sure I try to get something to put in the stomach or to rock it or something to quiet the child. In terms of authority, I have great authority because I'm bigger, I'm smarter, I'm faster, I'm stronger, okay? I can pretty much do what I want with that child. I could throw it out the window if I wanted to, okay? I have all kinds of authority over that child. Do whatever I want. The older that child gets, if I'm developing a relationship and if I have developed in the child a heart for obedience, and if I'm developing in the child character and relationship and I'm communicating and helping him understand his heart and using all the forms of communication the Bible talks about, I am going to develop increasing amount of influence because the child knows I care. He sees where I am right, and he begins to understand life as I am training him to. And he allows me, when your child takes their first step, they've already declared a little bit of independence. When they've taken the first step, they already do not need you as much as they did. Your authority diminishes slightly at that first step. Hopefully your influence is growing. That's what you want to be concerned about. Too many of us focus on authority. We want to keep this authority line straight across here all the way. And then we begin, the older the child gets, the more we hammer, okay? And we want to keep that authority line up. But if we can focus on influence, far more effective and powerful for life change and growth. And the older the child gets, as I develop the relationship and I correct the way God has called me to do it, I develop influence. By the time he's 18 or 21 or whatever, and they leave home or get married, I really have no more authority over that child. Biblically, he's to leave me and cleave to his or her partner and or do the call of God. And I have no more authority, but I may have a tremendous amount of influence. How many of you called your parents in the last year and asked their advice about something? Okay? You didn't really need to. Most of you, I'm assuming, are probably on your own, living by yourself or somewhere else. But because of their influence in your life, you still want to know what they think. And that's what you want to develop in children. Well, let me just share a few things. If you'll turn to 1 Thessalonians, thinking about relationship and communication. Paul is writing to the Thessalonians, and he's just reminding them of his visit to them and what his ministry was like when he was there. And I love this passage because in this passage, he compares what he did in his ministry to them with a father and a mother and a nurse, or maybe we might say a nanny. I'm going to begin reading. In verse 7, he talks about how they entreated and how they exhorted and how they spoke to them. And he said that we didn't seek our own glory. We didn't use flattering words. We didn't try to deceive you into doing what we wanted. We didn't try to manipulate you into what we wanted. We were upright men of integrity. Verse 7, but we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because ye were dear unto us. For ye remember, brethren, our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God. Ye are witnesses, and God also, how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves among you that believe. As ye know, how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children. And here's where I believe teaching can come in. If you're a teacher, do teachers have opportunities to speak into children's lives? We do. If you're not a teacher, if you're just someone working in the kingdom and someone sitting in your living room, you can take on, by the grace of God, the role of a father or a mother in the life of this person. Verse 12, that ye would walk worthy of God, who hath called you unto his kingdom and glory. For this cause also thank we God without ceasing, because when ye received the word of God, which ye heard of us, ye received it not as the word of men, but as it is in truth the word of God, which effectually worketh also in you that believe. Notice the fruit of his training and his development of their character. For ye, brethren, became followers of the churches of God, which in Judea are in Christ Jesus, for ye also have suffered like things of your own countrymen. Look, their faith has reached full fruition. They too now are being persecuted for following Jesus Christ. And in the New Testament, there wasn't much more proof than you could get than that you were fully a believer and a follower. And so Paul's work in the lives of the Thessalonians had full fruition. Now, notice in verse 9, he says, let me just read it in the NIV. Surely you remember, brothers, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day while we preached. Their life matched their words. Now, I think as teachers and parents, our lives have to match with what we say if we hope to have any credibility with children. And he reminds them of how holy and blameless he was among them. And he encouraged, comforted, urged, entreated, pleaded with them. He developed a relationship with them that had integrity. I'd like to just consider now a few things. How is character developed? We've been hitting at it from a number of different angles here in the last minutes. Let's just think about some other ways that character is developed. Character is developed in us by seeing in other people. It's modeled to us. And so we watch people that we admire and respect. We tend to imitate. And if you're a parent, you see your children doing this. Forgive me, but my one-year-old, or he's less than one, he sees me wave my hand a certain way. I look over there, he's doing it too. Okay? And children do this all through, all the way up. If they respect you and love you, they will imitate. And this modeling process includes stories. I remember my first grade teacher, who is no longer living, but she was an older single lady, and some of you might have known her, Ruth Emsweiler. She told us a lot of missionary stories, okay? And she would read some stories like Call of the North, and she knew some of those people up there, and told us stories about how people experienced fear, and they prayed, I forget the man's name who started the work up there. It's maybe Fry, Harold Fry, maybe. How his wife was always afraid when he flew over there in the, you know, the uncharted wastelands of the north. And one day as she prayed for him as he took off in the plane, she saw angels under the wings. Okay. And I've never forgotten that story. It was told to me by someone that I admired, that I appreciated, and I remembered the things that she said and told me, and those stories still make an impression. I've thought of that when I've flown myself since, that perhaps there are angels under the wings when I fly as well. So character is modeled and taught in stories. And that's my second point. The stories that we hear, we absorb those traits and characteristics that we hear in stories. And we hear them in Vacation Bible School, we hear them in Sunday School, we hear them in our Christian schools. We read books. And whether it's the Chronicles of Narnia or The Hobbit or biographies of Christian men, even pioneer stories and the struggles that people faced, all of those things, as we read those growing up, they make an impact and shape how we think. I remember one story by Tolkien in Lord of the Rings, where this 20-year-old man, whose lineage was nobility, wanted to marry this lady that he saw, and he got to know her. But it so happened that she was immortal. Tolkien does this in his books; he mixes the mortal and the immortal. It so happened that she was immortal, and she was much older. Of course, she was immortal. But she looked young. And she looked his age. And in order to marry him, she would have to give up immortality and submit to death at some point in her life. And but she said, I'm willing to do that. But first of all, you need to go, and the bottom line is mature, grow up, develop. She didn't tell him like that, of course. But talking about character development. And so he goes and wanders the world for the next 20 years. And gets into all kinds of situations and takes on more and more responsibility, gets to know people and develops influence. And that picture sticks with me when I think about being a real person, being a whole person. That became part of my thinking as I thought about maturity and what it means to be a man. So stories shape us. As we get older, a third thing that shapes our character is abstracts, abstract principles, things that we are taught. And one of those would be what we call disruptive moments. Disruptive moments are when things like one for me would have been when a mentally handicapped brother was born into my family. My parents had a handicapped brother, okay? A disruptive moment. How do you respond? People look. He looks weird. He acts strange. It's disruptive. You have to adapt to that moment. For other people, it's a death in childhood or a sickness or a handicap in their own life or whatever it may be. It's a disruptive moment. And it's when we learn something and we are shaped by it. Fourth thing would be Scripture. And we haven't addressed it directly, but you understand from how we've used it today that the Bible itself is a teacher. And Ezra, in Ezra 7:10, talks about reading the Scripture, and his job was just to teach what the law said. And it shaped what people did and who they were. Hebrews 4:12, for the word of God is, can't quote it now, a sword, sharper than a two-edged sword, piercing even the dividing asunder. It is not a dead piece of literature. When we pick it up and read it, anything can happen because the Spirit of God is the driving force behind it. And so it's not a natural exchange in the natural sense. It's a spiritual, a divine encounter when we read Scripture. Another way that convictions are developed is the result of living with other people, living in a community of people. And this, of course, at first is in a family. And you may think, for instance, that something is okay, but for the sake of your children, you're going to avoid whatever it is. Because for the sake of your children, for the weaker brother, you're going to avoid those things. Or you may decide to do something, not because it's the only way it could be done, but because you want to develop in your children certain characteristics. And so it becomes the force of the family and the community developing character in the child. As we grow and change, our character is also shaped in relationship to God Himself. And I'd like to conclude by reading Psalm 139, a few verses there, and look at David's prayer. One thing I haven't talked about a whole lot directly is the fact that God ordains the days of our lives. And if we refuse to accept that as a factor in who we are and our character, we'll never understand or make sense out of what happens to us. But listen to David's prayer, beginning in verse 13. For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. How precious are also are thy thoughts unto me, O God. How great is the sum of them. Does God stop being that intimately involved in my life after I'm born? If he would stop there, why stop there is what I want to ask. Why would he be that concerned about that part of me and not the rest? And David affirms that in verse 23 and verse 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. I was sitting the other day at lunch with a 12-year-old boy, and some of you are going to know who this is, of course. But I was just sat down with my lunch next to him, and he was just finishing up his and got to chatting a little bit. And his dad is in jail, probably will be there for a very long time. And this boy knows that. And I sat down and asked him how it was going, chit-chat. And he told me, hey, I got a job this summer. I'm going to be 13 before school's out this year. He's only in sixth grade. School isn't easy. And I got a job this summer. Yeah, I said, oh, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to be a Mason. I said, oh, you're going to work for Mike. He said, yeah, I'm going to work for Mike. So that's great. I said, you know, we chatted a little bit. And then he said, I don't need to go to college to learn how to be a Mason. And I'm going to help a carpenter too. When Mike doesn't have work, I'm going to help a carpenter this summer too. And I said, hey, that's great. He said, you go for it. I said, you'll never be sorry you learned those trades. You'll never be sorry. Yeah, he says, I'm going to get my family out of where we live. I'm going to do something for my family. Well, it happened then like it happens now. I got interested in my lunch real quick there for a little bit. It caught me without warning. I started to cry because, you see, I know the two men. Sorry. I know the two men who are going to give him work. And it'll probably be more nuisance than benefit. But they've been there for his family all along. And what is Chris going to learn from the disruptive moments in his life? He's learning a lot, some very painful things. But God is faithful. Isn't that amazing? God is being faithful in Chris's life right now by giving him those opportunities. And as we started out with the question, how do we make sense out of what happens to us? Well, like Joseph, it can only be... only sense we can make out of things is if God knows what he's doing. That's really the only way. Proverbs 14:26 says, he who fears the Lord has a secure fortress. Now think about Chris. And for his children, it will be a refuge. Chris doesn't have a dad who fears the Lord and has provided a secure fortress. But you and I have the opportunity to stand in the gap, just like Paul did for the Thessalonians, just like countless other believers have done and have become parents to people who didn't have them.
I don't know Chris well, but you know, so here, I guess, Brandon, no one was there. It was just the two of you. So can't you see this boy talking like this, and his friends are there? Can you just see this? And they say, huh? What are you going to do? Ah. Can you see that? Well, I thought of that. That's one response people have. What's your problem? Think you're somebody, don't you? Trying to be somebody. And then I thought, you know, Brandon, you can see this. There's probably a lot of things wrong with that boy, but there are some things right. That's, well... talk about that later. Okay, discussion. Your questions, and I'm not going to answer them. Someone else will. Your questions or comments. I'll stand here for a little while and then we'll dismiss. It's fine. I mean, I'm perfectly comfortable. Yes, Dave.
I'm not glad to hear a discussion, but just a little bit of comment, comments about the question that I've probably had increasingly over the last couple of years about the role of spanking in school. And sometimes we hear we talk about it in relation to different students. Just the appropriateness or the type of instruction that should surround if that occurs, even whether it should occur.
I'm waiting. Spanking in school. When? How? What instruction? What's the goal?
This will not answer your question. But for my first 6 years, I don't think I spanked anybody. And that's been potential. And it seems as though this has gotten less and less as time has gone on. So I don't know if my thinking has progressed properly or not. I've been much, much more in favor of communicating with a parent. On a very, very high level, to get to a point where the parent understands the problem and is prepared to take spanking action. Certainly not saying that a school teacher should never spank a child, but just saying that I think we do well to put as much of the burden of responsibility and energy on a parent as we can. There may be times when we sense that a parent is not being responsible, we might feel like we're good at school. I'm in favor of that. But I'm just saying, as I track my own experience in schools, I find myself wanting to say, come on, yeah, this is something we need to do more than the teacher system.
Okay.
I think we can look at that from two different angles. I grew up in a home where my parents weren't Christian, and the times I got inspected at home. But generally, if I got spanked, it's usually an injury. And when I went to public school, I got in a lot of trouble. I got spanked many times. And as I look back at it, the different teachers that did that, did spank me, I said, God's will it. Because sometimes in punishment, we can see the character in people to model after. You know, we may not see that in our parents, but we see it in our teachers. And as a parent, I think sometimes as a teacher, backing out of a conversation with a student, we do not send the message home to pop and mom that our child is dead. I agree, communication is good, and I think we need it. And I like to keep on top of the situation with my children, find out what's going on at school, talk with the teachers, with parent-teacher conferences and things like that, and try to stay on top of the situation. But there are times that you can't always be there to find out of it. And unless the teacher's going to be communicative and let you know what's going on, you as a parent cannot always deal with the situation. So I'm looking at it from both perspectives, as a parent and as a student who grew up basically without knowing the Lord until I was in my mid-teens. think there are things, there are benefits for both sides. And as a parent, I've always endeavored to try and be an example of what I felt God would want me to be teaching my children. And I tried to find out what God has for me to show them. And I like to know what's going on otherwise.
Okay.
But that comes from the old school, I guess you could say. You know, sometimes you get away from Papa and Mom, you do little things, a few things, but, you know, they don't know about. So, and so that unless it's, you know, drastic, the teacher don't usually take a hold of it. So I think we need to work at it from both ends.
I know J. Irvin Fox said he the one that said he would not spank a child. But his situation was a little different, maybe. Of course, there are laws these days too, and but I'm not sure that they spank in public school anymore, do they? Yeah, and I think it might make a difference too if it's a Christian school or a public school as to how parents would relate or what their role would be. So it might be some difference, but okay. What else?
I thought concerning what Melvin said, I had some of the same feelings when I was in second grade. First grade of public school, second grade Christian parents and others started our church 32 years ago, and. Maybe even started this day school. As I remember those years from second to eighth, there was an awful lot of spankings. I mean, there was this. And then from that time until now, and then recently, the last 10 years of all in school, a lot. Not as a teacher, but as a board member and as a parent. It's been very few spankings. And one side of me says, well, our children, you know, they're from Christian homes now, and they're so much better, and they're, you know, they don't need spankings. Mm-hmm. And the other man, I wonder, have we laid down. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of other methods that can be used, mm-hmm. and so forth. But I still think there are times when that, and recently, mm-hmm. in the last 5 years, there's probably been several spankings. And some of those I was pleasant. I think they're tremendous bonding. In a serious situation, there can be tremendous bonding between a teacher and a student.
Okay. What else?
One of the things that made me, like I said, I wasn't raised in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. But when I was in BS, I got to talk to a lot of young people, and we started comparing notes and about, you know, how we were raised and what we did and what we were for. And I thought it was terrible, some of the things they did in Christian day school compared to what we did in public school. We got big trouble in public school.
Anthony?
The Bible says in Proverbs about in relation to discipline, about using the rod to save a soul from hell. You know, possibly ending up dying when we use the rod. Obviously, it was used in connection to a very severe problem. Mm-hmm. It was evil, inside. Mm-hmm. But it was strong as a condition.
Mm-hmm.
Children from parents from homes where parents were
Mm-hmm.
And one day this time, I was back in the school when I saw it, was when the board member was calling to the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was partly because of the self and the living experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that that is true.
Mm-hmm. 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 Okay. Yeah, and I want to say that I think that parents, the poorer the job the parents do at home, the more trouble there is at school. That's true. And so I think that was Melvin's comment was, let's see if we can't encourage parents to be responsible at home, assume responsibility, be involved. And I think that's good. But you are aware, too, of course, that no spanking in school does... a spanking in school does not do much good if the parents are not in support of whatever this is. You know that. Okay, do we have any other questions?
Particularly disruptive moments, those things in life. Bad things happen to good people. Mm-hmm. This guy not always in charge of what's going on. It's not a loaded question.
Did you hear that, Brandon? He didn't want to hear that. Tell him again.
Thinking of the disruptive moments and why do bad things happen to good people. The whole thing, you know, we don't live in like this idealistic world. Is God always in charge of everything goes on? It's not a loaded question.
When you develop a reason to take
it. Yeah.
You're asking if God is in charge of those bad things.
And what part of the picture is if you were painting a moral on the wall, where was he in the picture?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody knows that except that you were just to look at what I would say is that the disruption at first is a result of sin and its influence and effects around us in our lives. Grace is when God steps into the picture and makes something out of it, redeem it, and reverse the process of sin. I'm not.
You're not addressing. Yeah, you're not addressing the initial action, which you look at Job. You know, you get a picture there. But that is a big question. What is God making happen? What is He allowing to happen? And what? Let's see. Go ahead.
First part of 1 Peter chapter 1. There's a few verses in there. If you need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations. But the trial of your faith being much more precious than gold and perishable, though it be tried by fire, often. We just as Christian people, not for the unsaved people, this verse would hold true, but as we as God's children, as we experience disruption in life, isn't it that God is wanting to teach us something? Mm-hmm. Well, Peter says, if need be, and that really caught my attention recently. When I experience a trial, apparently God is wanting to develop something in my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He sees the end from the beginning. It's difficult for us to see that. We may experience it.
Mm-hmm.
But a disruption in our lives is for our ultimate benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, in one sense, I believe God is, in my own mind, I think that God is responsible.
Yeah.
But not because He sees us or desire to give us a discomfort. He knows what I do.
Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty hard to explain all the whys and wherefores of life. but God is present in and around them. Anthony?
You say sometimes that sin and suffering is always, or suffering and mistreatment is always a result of man's sin. And I think that's definitely correct. We try to back up, before God created man, did he not set in motion the law of sowing and reaping? So from that standpoint, God is, at least we can say, over it. Mm-hmm. God looked at all the suffering that innocent people would face. He could have reversed that before he created man. Mm-hmm. But in making man, we say, free moral agents and people of choice, mm-hmm. and also set in motion the law of sowing and reaping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least the world's not out of God's control.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't entirely answer the question at all. Mm-hmm. Taking the middle of the person's suffering, at least to remember that this was all in at least the scope of God's control, his plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes we forget, we look at suffering and we say, well, you know, it's a result of sin. And basically, a lot of times it is. Mm-hmm. There are times that God calls people to go through suffering for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the illustration that Jesus gave was of a man who was
true. Okay, you will have time for more discussion even of these matters at the end of the second session this afternoon.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.